Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime.
And good day, everybody. I appreciate you joining us for another edition of Midrats. And it looks like we got our software working this week, so we are live. So if you're with that esteemed cohort, feel free to scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room. And if you have some observations you would like to share during the course of the show or some questions you would like to ask our guests, that's the perfect place to put it. We'll be monitoring during the course of the show and would be glad to go in and roll that into our questions. And if you don't already, I'd also like to invite you to go to iTunes, Spreaker, Spotify, wherever you get your podcasts, and go ahead and subscribe to Midrats. That way you'll make sure and grab every episode as it comes along. And for today's show, we're going to look back 2 years to this month to the events that I know a lot of us have been waiting for a really good book to cover. And it's something that myself and others have generally described as the humiliation since the fall of Saigon over a half century ago. The negotiated surrender of the Taliban and the retreat from Kabul and the withdrawal from Kabul under the grace of our enemy in the summer of 2021 remains mostly an undertold story. We get bits and pieces, but you really don't get the one-stop shopping from the beginning to the end. A lot of that had to do with 6 months afterwards, the Russo-Ukrainian war kicked off, and that took a lot of the national security mind space to invest their time in. But that's no longer a problem. And today we're going to have come to on Midrats Jerry Dunleavy. He co-authored with James Hassan a book that is that one-stop shopping. I can't recommend it enough. Kabul, the untold story of Biden's fiasco and the American warriors who fought to the end. And James is with us. James, welcome to Midrats.
It's actually Jerry, and I'm very glad to be here. Thank you.
Well, Jerry, I don't know why I wasn't calling you Jerry, because it's actually on my... So my thing, Jerry. Sorry about that. I actually wrote down Jerry, but who knows? But hey,
well, good. We're both great. Either one of us is fantastic.
Sorry about that. Well, you know, that's the joys of doing a show live is it keeps you humble. But I wanted to dive in because I kind of mentioned it early on in my opening. That we've been waiting for a while to really get the story of what happened in August of 2021. And you and your co-author kind of put it together. And I just wanted to ask you, you know, how did you and your co-author put that together? And, you know, how has the rollout been going so far for your book? And generally speaking, for the folks that haven't read it or seen your other interviews, what is the breadth of the book and what it covers?
Yeah. So James and I have been longtime friends here in Washington, D.C. And James was a former Army captain. He did a tour in Afghanistan in 2014, 2015. So he was stationed on the Afghanistan-Pakistan border in Khost Province and near Nangarhar. My brother is still in the Army and has done multiple tours in Afghanistan as well. So this was an issue that was near and dear to our hearts. And, you know, James and I had wanted to write a book about Afghanistan for a while. Unfortunately, because of 20 years of mistakes, yes, over a 20-year war, but particularly because of President Biden's decision to withdraw and the way that he decided to do it, conditionless withdrawal without a plan about how to get Americans out, how to get Afghan allies out, without a plan about how to keep the Afghan military fighting, because pulling U.S. troops also meant pulling U.S. logistics and U.S. ISR and U.S. advisors and U.S. contractors, all of which the Afghan military had been built around, because of Biden's decision to close Bagram instead of using it as a place to run a much safer evacuation. And then, of course, because of, because of all of that, all of those decisions, the Taliban swept across Afghanistan in 2021. And James and I, our desire to write a book about Afghanistan obviously became, in our view, went from being a desire to a necessity, because we really thought that the story needed to be told, the truth needed to be told on how this happened and why it happened and why it was preventable, because we think that there needs to be accountability, which there's been none. No one fired, no one resigned, no one held accountable whatsoever. And we also think that we need to make sure that this never happens again, because, after 20 years of war, the Taliban is back in charge, and our final days there were marked with chaos and death and 13 Americans losing their lives, 200 Afghans losing their lives, and well over 1,000 Americans left behind, tens of thousands of Afghan allies left behind. And as our book title shows, Kabul, the untold story of Biden's fiasco and the American warriors who fought to the end, we put the onus on, for all of this largely on President Biden, because he was the driving force here behind these bad decisions. But also, as our book title shows, we also focus a lot on the heroism of the, especially of the American service members on the ground who were put in an impossible situation by their commander-in-chief, but within the strictures of that impossible situation did perform heroically and did do a lot of good on the way out.
Well, Jerry, I'm from an older generation that was involved in the Vietnam thing and well recall the helicopters leaving the embassy there, which I think one of the good, more interesting aspects of your book is you've tied that event and the things that led up to that and wrap it up so that when you conclude at the end by looking forward and at the current situation both Ukraine and what we're dealing with in China, that you've kind of tied it all up together in one nice piece, in addition to having the, as you say, the stories of the heroism of our young Marines and soldiers and airmen and sailors, for that matter, involved in this mess. But talk a little bit about that background. Talk a little bit about what you perceive led Mr. Biden to make the decisions he made and accelerate, as it did, as you point out, the timeline to get the troops out of there.
Yeah, so one of the earliest stories that we tell in this book, because we're trying to get inside President Biden's mind, why did he do what he did, and why did he do it the way that he did it, when pretty much everybody around him was warning him it would be a disaster and debacle? And we look back to the end of the Vietnam War. So President Biden at the time was a very young senator, and he joined the Senate a little bit too late to be able to make his mark on ending the war in Vietnam. So the war in Vietnam was on its way to ending the way that we all know it did, but President, then Senator Biden, still wanted to make his mark somehow. And so as the North Vietnamese were marching south towards Saigon in 1975, President Ford was trying to do everything that he could to try to get as many of the South Vietnamese allies who had fought alongside us, try and get them out, evacuate them, and bring many of them to the United States. And most people don't know this, but the loudest and most vociferous voice opposing doing that, opposing the U.S. effort to help out our South Vietnamese allies, that voice was a young Joe Biden. And he did everything he could in the Senate to try to stop that from happening, to block U.S. funding to get some of our South Vietnamese allies out ahead of the North Vietnamese takeover. And what he famously said, and I dug this up, you know, from old Senate speeches and Senate archives and in the Congressional Library, the Library of Congress. What Biden famously said was, you know, we don't have a moral obligation to a 100,001 or to one South Vietnamese. Now, luckily, Biden's attitude was overruled, and we did thankfully get a lot of South Vietnamese out. But some of them we didn't, and, you know, we know what happened to many of them, re-education camps and torture and sometimes even killed. And so but to us, that was important to include in this book, because I really think that mentality, that lack of caring for the allies that had fought alongside us in another long war in Vietnam, I think that President Biden brought that same attitude decades later to the presidency. And you could see it play out in the exact same way, where the U.S. withdrew in 2021 without any plan being put together by the Biden administration about how to get out our Afghan allies. And of course, people know about the Americans that were left behind and the Biden administration's false claims about how many Americans were left behind. But where we also tried to shine a spotlight on the Afghan allies left behind, there were tens of thousands of them that worked and served alongside us, especially as interpreters. And that was very dangerous for them. And we made promises to them that President Biden didn't keep. And I think that saga in Vietnam when he was a young man helps to explain his actions later. And, you know, it is, I suppose, just very darkly fitting that he ended up getting his, you know, second Saigon as a result of that attitude.
You know, having one thing that, especially in the first quarter of your book, the one thing that I really have to credit y'all for doing is, at least in the military, in a lot of places, there's a certain cliche and there's a certain honor code, you know, the old will not lie, cheat, steal, nor tolerate those among you who do. And we expect politicians and political appointees to have a tenuous grasp in that fuzzy area between a spin and a lie. You know, Jake Sullivan, Anthony Blinken, I think you outline some really good points in that order. And including myself, a lot of people have looked at the chairman of the Joint Chiefs, General Milley, as somebody who seems to be, if not in a tenuous grasp of the truth, perhaps ill-briefed. But when you really look at how y'all researched, this is what they said at time X. However, this is what they knew at time X minus Y beforehand. That are clearly lies, whether you were looking at some of the statements that y'all outlined from General McKenzie, whether you're looking at Secretary of Defense, but till very recently before then, retired four-star general, Secretary Austin, and also former mm-hmm. Admiral Kirby. And it kept reminding me, like my co-host was mentioning the experience of Vietnam, I was at Fifth Fleet at 9/11 in 2001 and during the fall and through the new year. As that whole thing was kicking off, one thing that kept coming up, especially those I served with who were knew what Vietnam was like and afterwards, that let's just make sure and not do another Vietnam militarily. And up until I left active duty at the end of that decade, mostly focused on Afghanistan, we started to see hints of it. And we actually, I've called him on here before, the oldest Army major I've ever seen in my life, who was a civil affairs guy in Vietnam who was brought back from retirement to help us out in Kabul. But your book really outlines the fact that the damage to, again, the uniformed military from their senior to leaders openly telling falsehoods that they had to know at the time were going to be shown to be outright lies. I know there's a lot of things on the backroom floor, and you know, working in D.C., I know you have a certain layer of cynicism, but did it come across to you as you did the research just how blatant it was, as opposed to being poorly briefed? Because it reads that way.
It's painful, and it's hard to imagine that this was just truly this much willful ignorance, this much ignorance. When it came to the multitude of falsehoods coming out of everybody from the president on down, including Blinken and Sullivan and the generals and the military brass, almost everything that they said about the reality on the ground in Afghanistan was false, from their false claims about Al-Qaeda being gone from Afghanistan, and as President Biden said, when the reality was that the alliance between the Taliban and Al-Qaeda was as strong as ever. That was deeply disappointing. You had President Biden, the people around him, and even General Milley constantly misleading about the size of the Afghan military. And I'll get to why I think that's important in a second, but this constant mantra throughout 2021 was that the Afghan military was 300,000 strong, and so obviously they should be able to stand up and fight the Taliban. This was misleading in so many different ways that it's kind of almost funny, because it wasn't 300,000 strong. Part of how they get that number was combining the size of the military with the size of the police and border guard. And the size of the military on paper was actually more like 180,000. So we're already talking about a vastly smaller number. On top of that, everybody knew that there was some percentage of the Afghan military that were essentially ghost soldiers, so just soldiers that were. And so the number shrinks even further from there. On top of that, throughout 2021, as they continued talking about this 300,000 strong Afghan army figure, the U.S. had pulled all of the support that military needed. And it was already a very shaky military to begin with. And we pulled everything that they needed, their logistics, their contractors, their support, their ISR. And on top of that, we're in the middle of Afghan fighting season against a very strong Taliban enemy, and the Afghan military, parts of it are fighting, parts of it are crumbling. And so this 300,000 figure is just such a total fantasy. It was throughout 2021 just a fictional number, but it's what we pinned everything on. And why I'm so why I talk about this particular lie so much is that U.S. strategy, such as it was in 2021, was centered around this military continuing to fight and keep the Taliban at bay as we slowly started to do the things that we should have been doing in terms of getting Americans and Afghan allies out. But our strategy was centered around a completely fictional number, a completely fictional sense of the size and strength of the Afghan army on one hand, and a total dismissal of the strength of the Taliban, but also the intentions of the Taliban on the other, as the Biden administration made claims about the Taliban not being interested in a military conquest and there not being a military solution. Well, there was a military solution, at least in the eyes of the Taliban, and they, you know, carried out that military solution to completion. And this naivete, if you want to call it that, or this willful lying, which I think is probably more likely, it had devastating impacts on the country. And throughout 2021, the American people were just not being told the truth about what was happening there. And obviously, it all collapsed very rapidly and was a total disaster. And it was foreseeable, but there was a lot of dishonesty that clouded what was going on.
One of the things I think that has to be discussed is the effect of the Doha agreements initially reached by the Trump administration, and whether as a result of Taliban breaches of those agreements, which you pretty well describe in the book, we should have said, no, we're not leaving until we're darn well ready. And, you know, how much of an advantage did it give the Taliban knowing that, that we had a date, a drop-dead date when we were going to leave and they could run amok?
Yeah. Well, we have a whole chapter on the Doha Agreement in the book. Ultimately, our conclusion is that this is ultimately on President Joe Biden, but we don't really try to soft sell the Doha Agreement, because it was a very flawed agreement that the U.S. and the Taliban reached during the Trump administration. Zalmay Khalilzad, who is sort of the architect of the Doha Agreement, among the many, I think, duplicitous things that he did while putting that agreement together is he cut the Afghan government out of it completely. And I think that was very demoralizing for the Afghan government to be cut out of this agreement and then forced into an agreement that was pretty flawed. That being said, the Doha Agreement did have conditions that went along with the U.S. agreement to withdraw our troops. The Taliban simply did not follow any element of the Doha Agreement. I think probably the most glaring example, of course, is just this unbroken alliance between al-Qaeda and the Taliban. And you can see that alliance, you know, continuing even to this day. Ayman al-Zawahiri, Osama bin Laden's number two and the former head of al-Qaeda, after Osama bin Laden was killed, he was hanging out in Kabul after the Taliban takeover in a safe house from Sirajuddin Haqqani, a very top Taliban leader and the leader of the Haqqani network in 2022. Today, the Taliban government has members who are not just members of the Taliban, but are members of al-Qaeda in their government. And so that element of the Doha Agreement is pretty glaring, that the Taliban clearly wasn't following it, but they weren't following any parts of it. And so when President Biden took office, he had no obligation to follow through on our end of the bargain, because the Taliban was not following through on theirs. And, you know, one of the first things that President Biden did related to Afghanistan when he took office was to keep Zalmay Khalilzad on, despite a very, terrible record in Afghanistan. And Secretary Blinken and others in the Biden administration, you know, said he had to be kept on to continue his, quote, vital work, end quote. And so they embraced Zalmay Khalilzad. They embraced the architect of the Doha Agreement. Despite them now trying to point to the Doha Agreement as the reason why they had to do everything, it's just an excuse that doesn't wash. It's just not true. This was ultimately their decision, the Biden administration's decision, and ultimately a decision by President Joe Biden himself to do what they did. And it was predictably going to be a disaster, and a disaster it was.
Another great service that you did in this book, and it was really straight out there. You didn't sugarcoat it, which you often see when this topic comes up. It's kind of like Zal, you know, some of the universal constants here is y'all outline over and over what at the time I heard from people that I was communicating with, both during and after, as they were trying to get people out. Is a department which seems to never be held to account, and that's the U.S. State Department. And everything from ignoring the 13th of July dissent cable from, a dozen or two people in the embassy there, mm-hmm. warning about mm-hmm. what was happening, to their, even at the time, was seen as ridiculous CONUS bureaucratic-based COVID requirements to get in and out of country.
Mm-hmm.
Talk a bit about what you discovered about the State Department's role in this fiasco during the course of your research.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, a lot of people in the Biden administration made terrible, terrible mistakes and decisions. And the person ultimately responsible, you know, the buck stops at the top, so President Biden. But the State Department performed horrifically during all of this. They never did any of the basic things that you would need to do to plan for a proper evacuation of Americans and of the Afghan allies that we had made promises to. You mentioned COVID. You know, COVID, the COVID pandemic was allowed to impact the functioning of the U.S. Embassy in Kabul to a point where during the spring of 2021, where we needed to be really ramping up our efforts to process Afghan allies and get them out of the country, we essentially, the U.S., the Biden administration, essentially shut the embassy down for a period of time, days, many days, because of COVID cases. And so at a time where time is of the essence, and we have a ticking clock, and we have the Taliban on the march, you know, we are stopping our processing of special immigrant visas and stopping our processing of Afghan allies because of COVID cases. And you know, it just shows the skewed priorities. And the State Department never planned properly for the non-combatant evacuation. In military jargon, it's a NEO. They never planned for a NEO properly, and ultimately, it was a disaster, and tens of thousands of Afghans, allies, and you know, we think well over 1,000 Americans were left behind. And one thing that I'll just add is that I'm currently on the House Foreign Affairs Committee. I'm an investigator there, helping investigate the Afghanistan withdrawal. I'm just speaking in my personal capacity as the author of the book, but the committee, we recently had Command Sergeant Major Jake Smith come and testify to us. And in 2021, Jake was tasked with overseeing the closure of these military bases around the country. And in early 2021, he testified that he had members of the State Department from the U.S. Embassy in Kabul come and visit Bagram to do a site survey. And he told them in no uncertain terms that to do an evacuation through Kabul would be a disaster. And he says that they agreed with him. And he told them, you know, we have an old evacuation plan here through Bagram, and you know, our plan says something like we'd have to get 50, 60, 70,000 people out. You can't do that through Kabul. And the State Department told him, well, we think that the number is actually going to be more like 120, 130, 140,000 people. And Jake was like, well, you really can't do a evacuation through Kabul with those numbers. But what that shows is not just that everybody knew that doing the evacuation through Kabul would be a disaster, but it also shows that the State Department was aware of the scale of the evacuation that they would have to end up doing. But Antony Blinken and the rest of the State Department never did proper planning for that. And we could see it on our television screens that they hadn't planned for what they had to end up doing. And it's really just through the sheer heroism of those U.S. troops on the ground that there was any, you know, that anyone was able to get out. The lack of planning was just unbelievable, and it resulted in, you know, a lot of broken promises and a lot of Americans and Afghan allies getting left behind. And a lot of that is the fault of the State Department.
Yeah, there are a couple of quotes from late in the book, well, not that late, page 169. Administration decision makers had theorized a best-case scenario and organized everything around that outcome without considering whether things might turn out differently. You know, military planners, we're always talking about, you know, what's plan B, what's plan C, what's, you know, what do we do if this doesn't work? And I got the impression there was none of that. And let me give you the other quote that I thought was good. Even while drowning in a crisis, bureaucrats were territorial as ever. The State Department deemed the NEO to be exclusively its operation and guarded it jealously. I mean, you go in with no plan or a plan that won't work, and then you pretend like you're in charge of it all and claim credit later.
That's exactly what happened. I mean, the State Department was not planning for this, and they, you know, if you're smart, and, you know, I think that this is sort of military doctrine as well, is that you're supposed to plan for worst case scenarios. That's just not what we were doing. We were planning for calling it a best case scenario doesn't do justice to how crazy it was what we were doing, because we were planning for an impossible scenario. A scenario where the U.S. up and leaving in an instant, essentially, and where we slowly maybe sort of start to get around to getting some people out, there was no universe where that was going to work. It wasn't going to work in the best case, and the best case was never going to happen because the Taliban was on the march, and the Taliban had a plan when we didn't, and the Taliban executed on that plan. And, yeah, I mean, of course, bureaucracy comes into it. Not wanting to plan for a NEO comes into it. But it's just this perfect confluence of bad decisions and just not understanding or not wanting to understand the reality of Afghanistan and the reality of what was happening on the ground. And it's just really tragic, and it ended in disaster.
It's that not wanting to accept the reality on the ground. You can, back in, was it 1993 in Somalia, you can excuse some of the mistakes made there because we hadn't been there that long, really, relative. But we had 2 decades of experience in Afghanistan. And yet, you know, everybody in a positive way likes to talk about the interagency and whole of government efforts. And y'all outlined real well that it almost seems as if everybody was executing decisions made by people that had been unfrozen for 20 years. For instance, they didn't understand where there'd be a problem between wanting to do something that was a regular topic from anybody who had been in Afghanistan, the difference between a fighting season and the fact that the heart of the fighting season overlaps Washington, D.C.'s vacation season in August. And making decisions, you mentioned the numbers of people that were coming here. And it sounds like y'all didn't quite find, you know, where the key was that caused the switch. But all of a sudden out of D.C., was it a demand on getting the right people out, but getting numbers out that could be briefed from the White House, and that second order effect of a flood of the military-aged males that largely brought the chaos that really were the scenes that people saw, whether it was coming off a C-17 or the rush at the gates?
Yeah, so let me take kind of both of those. So, you know, President Biden, when he made his announcement on April 14th, 2021, he set the final withdrawal date. So when the last U.S. troops would be gone, he set that for September 11th, 2021. So the 20th anniversary of 9/11. This was, I mean, to any observer and to any American, I think that this was essentially just, I mean, to me and to a lot of people, it was a punch in the gut. It made no strategic sense whatsoever. It was entirely political. Perhaps it was some way that he was trying to get some sort of political win here or do some sort of victory dance on September 11, 2021, whatever it is that he wanted. It was flawed for many reasons. First, to pick a date that has no strategic value is a very bad idea. But like you mentioned, this is right in the middle of the Afghan fighting season. So spring and summer, you know, we've been fighting there for 20 years. We know when the Afghan fighting season is. We've done it for 2 decades. And, you know, April 14th to spring and September 11th to summer. And within that time frame was when the U.S. was very rapidly withdrawing. And so we rapidly withdrew from April 14th until July 2nd. We closed every remaining U.S. military base in Afghanistan. And July 2nd was when Bagram was closed. And what we were then basically reduced to was a very small troop contingent just in Kabul to try to keep the embassy and the airport running. But picking the middle of the fighting season just had absolutely devastating effect, because right at the moment when the Afghan military needed all of that support and air support and ISR and logistics and our contractors, they were suddenly gone. And the Taliban took over. I mean, it's very predictable that this would happen. And to your point about the situation at the gates at Kabul Airport after the Taliban had taken over, you know, there was a lot of shifting guidance from the State Department about who could get in and who couldn't. I think the State Department was very overwhelmed on the ground. The maximum number of consular officers, for instance, at all of Kabul Airport, the maximum number that it ever got to during the evacuation was 36. And for most of the time, it was a significantly smaller number of consular officers who were there from the State Department. A lot of these were volunteers who had not been trained on, you know, an evacuation from Afghanistan. And so it was thrown together. It was a mad scramble. It really was. And I think that the biggest challenge, or one of the biggest challenges related to the evacuation, was the U.S. having to rely on the Taliban for security outside that airport. Because of the decisions that Biden had made, we now found ourselves just in control of an airport, and the Taliban not just controlling everything out the gates and not just controlling everything in Kabul, but essentially controlling the entire country, which meant that everybody that we needed to get out, Americans and Afghans, were behind Taliban lines. And we largely had to rely on the Taliban to let them through that Taliban gauntlet to get out. And, you know, the Biden administration top officials kept calling the Taliban businesslike and professional. Well, you know, we talked to a lot of folks on the ground, a lot of Marines and others who witnessed the Taliban turning Americans away, beating Americans, beating Afghans, and even executing Afghans within full view of the Marines at Kabul Airport. And so this was not a businesslike and professional group. This is the same enemy that we have been fighting for 20 years. And we were relying on them to sometimes determine who got out and who didn't. And, you know, Americans were left behind, and tons of Afghan allies were left behind because of the precarious situation that we put ourselves in.
Yeah, I keep going back to the rosy scenario that was being painted, and I wonder how much of that disinformation was believed by the people in charge of making these decisions, because they had never been on the ground there. They didn't understand how hard a NEO is under the kind of conditions that they were under, any kind of condition, but let alone one where your most recent enemy is the one standing outside your gates pretending to provide protection. It is amazing to me I'll cover this early, but the amount of disinformation and misinformation that were being used to make the decisions. Talk a little bit about that, because a lot of people don't understand some of the cultural aspects of what the Taliban believe, which is that it's okay to lie to the infidel. And, you know, they may not completely lie, but they sure didn't exactly tell all the truth or act in a way that we thought they would act, or somebody thought they would act under the circumstances.
Absolutely. I mean, I think that a lot of the war in Afghanistan and a lot of the problems with it can be traced back to a lack of understanding of the Taliban and what the Taliban wanted. You know, the Taliban harbored al-Qaeda before 9/11 as they were carrying out attacks against our embassies in Africa, as al-Qaeda hit the USS Cole, And then, of course, as Al-Qaeda struck the World Trade Centers and the Pentagon, killed 3,000 people, the Taliban harbored them throughout that. And I remind people, just before 9/11, a couple days before, Al-Qaeda did the Taliban a solid by assassinating Ahmad Shah Massoud, who was the very effective leader of the Northern Alliance, a very effective anti-Taliban fighter. So right before 9/11 and right before Al-Qaeda knew and the Taliban knew that the U.S. was going to be invading, you know, Al-Qaeda made sure to take out the most effective anti-Taliban fighter in the country as well. And then once we were getting ready to invade after 9/11, the Taliban refused to hand over Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda leadership. So the Taliban was willing to be out of power for 20 years rather than break its alliance with Al-Qaeda. They're patient, and they were willing to do what they needed to do to take over again. And, you know, the predictions from the Biden administration that there could be some sort of peaceful or political settlements with the Taliban, predictions from Zal that the Taliban wasn't interested in a military conquest, were just untrue. And they were untrue to anybody that knew anything about the Taliban and what the Taliban wanted. This is a very determined group, and it was willing to be stuck out in the hinterlands for two decades rather than to compromise on its alliance with Al-Qaeda. And so, you know, they knew what they wanted. They had their eye on the prize. And, yeah, a lot of the times the Taliban would lie and deceive about what they wanted, but other times they were they approached a level of honesty sometimes. They were very happy with President Biden's withdrawal speech, and they made that happiness very clear and basically said that, you know, victory is now at hand and that sort of thing. So there was a lot of deceit over 20 years, but in 2021, they started to be pretty open about, yeah, we're going to take the country over. They started to be pretty honest about that. And, you know, it's exactly what they did. And, you know, we say in the book, this was a leadership failure, a political failure, a military failure, an intelligence failure. You know, every kind of failure that you could have, we had. But at the end of the day, it's not excusable because much of this was predictable and some of it was predicted. But President Biden just went forward anyway, even as the ground was shifting throughout the spring and summer, even as some folks at the embassy were sending up warning flares with that descent cable, warning about what the reality on the ground was. You know, even as all of that was happening, the Biden administration was just not acting like anything was going wrong. And there was a National Security Council meeting the day before the Taliban took over where they were still working out basic things about an evacuation, things that you would have wanted to work out 6 months, a year before. And they were trying to work these things out as the Taliban was knocking on the door of Kabul. And, you know, they scheduled a follow-up meeting the next day. And, you know, the next day the Taliban was in control of the whole country.
You know, I always thought that was a great vignette of the complete disconnect and the lack of either ability or interest in actually seeing what was going on. And one of the neat thing about your book that hopefully the listeners will take the opportunity to read is embedded in it are some other vignettes that are rather positive on some of the stories I'll bring up maybe in a question later. But I think one of the other things we've seen in the last 2 years, another echo of Vietnam, is there's been a lot of people either as an internal coping mechanism, but more often I've seen it as a way of trying to shift blame, has been to talk down the Afghan military writ large as being incapable or unable without any redeeming quality. And you have two stories of a couple of leaders that really stuck out to me. Lieutenant General Sami Sadat and Colonel Sohrab Azimi, who perhaps are a little bit different than that cliche we've heard a lot of people throw out recently.
Yeah. Yeah. So look, I mean, the Afghan military, it was a very shaky military, to be sure. The Biden administration did them no favors by lying about their size and strength, lying and trying to say that there was a 300,000 person military. I mean, just complete falsehoods about it. And of course, the Biden administration did a lot of damage to the ability of the Afghan military and Afghan Air Force to function by pulling those U.S. troops and ISR and contractors and logistics without any plan or any way of substituting for those things. So the Afghan military really found itself in a very dire position as the Taliban was at potentially its strongest position since the U.S. invasion. And as the Afghan military had just lost a lot of its very important key capabilities. And so, you know, you did have Afghan units surrender, and you did have some Afghan units dissolve, but there were Afghans that fought, and thousands of died fighting the Taliban in 2021. You know, the story of Azimi is very tragic because he and the men under his command went to rescue another Afghan unit. Killed a lot of Taliban, but then themselves became stranded as well. And part of why and how they became stranded, and this is just a story that repeated itself across the country in 2021, was that the U.S. support for the Afghan Air Force was also extremely critical. The Afghan military relied heavily on air support as a means of superiority over the Taliban. And oftentimes it was U.S. air support, but it was also Afghan air support as well. But the decisions that Biden made about the way that we did our troop withdrawal without coming up with ways to continue to keep the Afghan military and Air Force fighting and flying was that the Afghan Air Force was crumbling as well. And so Azimi's team found itself surrounded by the Taliban after some very vicious fighting, and the Afghan Air Force was just not able to get to them to rescue them. And the Taliban killed Azimi and his whole squad in cold blood, executed them. And, you know, within Afghanistan, Azimi was basically, you know, sort of a major military hero. And a very tragic one after his death. And Sami Sadat was a rising Afghan military leader. And I encourage everyone, of course, to buy my book, Kabul, but people should also check out the documentary Retrograde, because in that documentary, it centers around Sami Sadat, because the documentary was supposed to be about U.S. Special Forces embedded with the Afghans, but it very quickly became a different story because of Biden's withdrawal decision and Sami Sadat being left without that U.S. support. And he and the Afghans under his command fighting a series of battles across Afghanistan, attempting to keep the Taliban at bay. And you can just see, and you know, Sami has told this story because he did survive, but you could just see the impact of the U.S. presence being pulled, the impact that had on the Afghan military. And so, you know, they oftentimes, you know, some Afghans fought very valiantly, but it just wasn't enough as the Afghan military began to collapse and the Taliban began to move forward. And a lot of it just goes back to the fact that we had designed the Afghan military around U.S. support. And when that U.S. support was pulled, you know, the Afghan military was put in a very perilous position.
I think it's important, too, to talk about the descriptions you have of what the young soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines, and sailors were facing at that at the airport in Kabul, because it sounds like, I mean, it is worse than the worst nightmare you can have, and I think you've covered it very well in the book. But the situation where these our troops are inside a fence, but the in between them and the Taliban, to a certain extent, are these masses of people trying to get their way out of Afghanistan, and that is a real horror show. And I know when you talk to some of the returning troops about that they must have felt pretty strongly about that, and were I mean, somebody says like the worst thing you could ever see. I think.
Yeah, I mean the position that these young men and women were put in was an impossible position. The Taliban controlling the entire country, and us having to rely on the Taliban for security outside the airport, and the things that these young men and young women, these Marines and these other soldiers, it's unimaginable. The masses of crowds and having to see people being trampled to death, babies being trampled underfoot, babies suffocating as their mothers are trying to get them out. Some women throwing themselves on the razor wire rather than being sent back to the Taliban. People handing their kids over to Marines, just hoping that, you know, at least maybe my kid can get out, even if I can't. And that's to say nothing of the Taliban's brutality. The Taliban was not businesslike and professional, as the Biden administration tried to say. The Taliban was beating people and killing people and executing Afghans in front of us. And these were desperate, massive crowds, and this was an impossible situation that these Marines and soldiers were put in, where they were having to make life and death decisions about who gets in and who gets out. This is not the sort of situation that any of them should have ever been put in, but it was. And, you know, as we describe in the book, basically the situation at the Kabul airport, it was America. It was the average American service members at their best, but the American government at its very, very worst.
Another thing to have into consideration, and I kind of grinned a little bit, because there are not just U.S. units there. There were non-U.S. units there. And this, I shouldn't laugh about it, it's dark humor, but the reaction of the Turkish contingent in Kabul will be of zero surprise to anybody that had to deal with them while they were in Kabul. That's one story. But there's a couple of stories that one I had vaguely heard of, but no details, but another one completely slipped my mind. There are a couple of vignettes that just hint at the fact there's a lot of stories here that still need to come out. What if you could touch on a bit, a couple of important players that have been lost in a lot of the background. First of all was the U.S. Embassy Gurkha security attachment and the Husbandin, the 10th Mountain Division, had to do with them. And also, surprisingly, the Ukrainian Special Forces, how they were so essential in getting a lot of those important people that should get out of Kabul.
Yes, there are a lot of unsung heroes that I think that people don't know about. You know, we had the Gurkhas, and we had, of course, a lot of outside private and veteran-led groups as well. And how it was working was these private and veteran-led groups. Often working in the United States, but sometimes working on the ground in Afghanistan as well, were basically filling the void that the State Department had abandoned. So, you know, this should have been the State Department's job to be able to get Americans and Afghan allies to the gates, but the State Department dropped the ball. And so you had these private groups working to get people out. And you also had various different groups of U.S. troops and service members coordinating with these outside groups to get people in through secret gates at Kabul airport, or to give people call signs in the crowd so that Marines would be able to go in and pluck people out, venture out into the crowd and pull people out as they needed to. And so, you know, everybody was working under an insane clock, because we knew that the time was coming that when we'd be running out of time. And so these Marines and other forces at the gates were working 24/7 trying to get people out. And you mentioned the Ukrainians, and I'm glad you did, because Ukrainian special forces also did a fair number of heroics, helping get people out as well, helping get NATO country folks out of Afghanistan, also helping get Afghan interpreters and that sort out as well. And so, you know, the Ukrainians there, and there were a lot of different nations that, you know, that contributed. And so there was a lot of heroism during those 2 weeks that we don't want people to forget about, because it's important always to keep in mind that no matter the terrible situation that all these people were put in, these young service members just performed unbelievable heroics. It's just unfortunate that because of the situation they were put in, and, you know, even taking into account what all that their heroics were able to accomplish, Americans and Afghans were still left behind. And maybe we can get into this a little bit more, but because of our reliance on the Taliban, ISIS-K was able to sneak in an attack and kill 13 Americans and wound dozens more and kill 200 Afghans. And so, you know, a deadly and devastating blow to our efforts there in our final days in Afghanistan.
Speaking of we don't have a whole lot of time, but let me ask this question. At the end of the book, you discuss the effect of this withdrawal on both Russian intentions and what China's up to. And I think one of the things that was interesting to me is that China's telling Taiwan, you can't trust the Americans. Remember what they did in abandoned Vietnam, and now they did the same thing to the Afghans. Talk a little bit about what the Russians and Chinese think they learned about the way we bailed from Afghanistan.
Well, I think that we make an extremely convincing fact-based case that, look, Vladimir Putin has wanted to do a full invasion of Ukraine for a long time. But I think that we make the case that the debacle in Afghanistan and the way that NATO and the U.S. looked like they were in a complete shambles was the final push that Vladimir Putin needed in his mind to finally launch this invasion. It's exactly what he did. I mean, Afghanistan fell, and the Taliban, the U.S. retreated in August 2021, and the massive Russian buildup that led to the invasion of Ukraine started immediately after. And when it comes to Russia, I mean, excuse me, when it comes to China, you know, this was a propaganda coup for them. They call it the Kabul moment, China does. And this is something that the Chinese came up with as the Taliban took over Afghanistan, August 2021, and even this week, the second anniversary, they returned to this idea of the quote unquote Kabul moment, basically telling Taiwan, look, don't go down this road. Don't try to fight. Don't pursue independence. Don't try to act like an independent country, because the United States is not going to be there for you. Look at what they did in Afghanistan. Look at how that turned out. Look at the Afghan allies left behind, and that is what would happen to you. And so, you know, we basically gave the Chinese Communist Party a big propaganda victory, and one that they continue to use 2 years later to undermine Taiwan's confidence and to try to undermine the friendship between the U.S. and Taiwan and to try to convince the Taiwanese, don't bother fighting because the U.S. won't be there for you.
I agree. Y'all made a really firm case there. And I wanted to steal a couple more minutes of your time because I had a question I wanted to touch on because a few minutes ago you did mention that, you know, I believe it was almost 18 months before we had lost anybody in Afghanistan. We added 13 killed in the explosion to add to the other 2,448 Americans that were killed. And in working on this book, I know you and your co-author had to spend a lot of time talking to people, especially the detailed stories y'all talked about in the build-up to that. Over the course of the last month, there's a quote by Ernst Jünger that it kept coming to mind. It was, quote, "The state, which relieves us of our responsibility, cannot take away our remorse, and we must exercise it," unquote. And the remorse part that everybody has to do individually, in your discussions with those that were there at that final departure, how are things going in that regard? And there are things that people need to be cognizant of for that cohort that was there to do the final retreat from Kabul.
You know, the biggest thing that the Marines and other troops at Kabul Airport, the most common refrain that we hear is the idea of moral injury, that the situation that they were put in, where their hands were tied behind their back as they watched the Taliban commit atrocities, and as they were forced to make life and death decisions about which Afghans were able to get out and which had to stay behind, and as they were forced into a position where we were relying on the Taliban for security, and as they had to witness these massive crowds and witness the chaos and witness death in the crowd, and then of course the bomb going off and more death. Moral injury is what we hear a lot from them, and I'd love to just note, when it comes to the bombing at Abbey Gate, this was carried out by a terrorist by the name of Abdul Rahman Al-Ghari, and he had been captured by the United States and Indian intelligence, actually, when he tried to carry out an attack in New Delhi back in 2017. And he was sitting in prison at Bagram in 2021. And so if the United States had held on to Bagram, that wouldn't have just been smart because it would have been a much better place to do an evacuation from. But Al-Ghari, the Abbey Gate bomber, and the thousands of other ISIS-K terrorists who were sitting in that prison would have still been in prison. But the first thing that the Taliban did when they took Bagram is they freed all of those terrorists from that jail. And Al-Ghari decided to use his newfound freedom from the Taliban to come and kill Americans at the gate. And so when the Biden administration talks about how the Taliban was being businesslike and professional, I just try to remind everyone that that bomber who killed those Americans was freed from prison by the Taliban. And they knew that they were freeing ISIS-K prisoners, and they knew that the people that they were freeing would very likely try to go and attack and kill Americans, and one of them did.
Yeah, and I think one of the good things about your book is you have little vignettes by the families and friends of the 13 Americans who were killed in the back of the book, and that is a humbling experience to read that. We have used up your time, however, and for this show, and we always ask our guests what they're working on next and if we're going to see something from you. I know you're involved, as you said, in the investigation of this matter. Is it going to stop you from continuing to report things?
No. So you know, what's next for me is I'm continuing to promote the book. I encourage everybody to buy Cobble, and I do encourage everybody to follow the House Foreign Affairs Committee's investigation into the Afghanistan withdrawal. Something that's coming up on August 29th is there's going to be a roundtable with many of those Gold Star families of the 13, and they're going to be meeting with members of Congress like Chairman McCaul and other members to share their stories and to demand accountability from the Biden administration. So that's what's next up, and I encourage everyone, of course, buy the book, but also keep your eyes on that that roundtable at the end of August, because it's going to be important.
Thank you, Jerry, very much for the last hour. Thank you very much for your book, Cobble. There's a link to it on the show page. It's a really important book that you and your co-host worked on. I really appreciate it. Appreciate you coming on talking it. We'll definitely take an eyeball on that 29 August panel discussion, and I wish you the best on the continuing rollout of the book and the reception I hope and it deserves to receive.
Thank you so much. And it was great talking to you guys. I really appreciate all the excellent questions. Thank you.
Well, thank you for being with us.
And thank you everybody for joining us for another edition of Midrat. And until next time, I hope you have a great Navy day. Cheers.
Maloney wants to marry me, and so leave the Strand and Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame. For love has fairly drove me silly, hoping you're the same. It's a long way to Tipperary, it's a long way to go, it's a long way to Tipperary. Sweetest girl I know. Goodbye, Piccadilly.